Sunstone presents The Further Adventures of Paul. Did women exercise pastoral power in the first 100 years? Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
Presenting this paper this morning will be Mick Smith, who is seeking a PhD at UCLA and as such is representing UCLA here at the symposium. Responding to his paper is Janet Ellingson. She received a BA in English from BYU and is working on a graduate degree in history at UCLA. She wants you to know also that she is responding to the paper as a Mormon woman and not especially as a scholar in this area.
Thank you. There's one correction. The title was misprinted in the programs and whatnot. It should say, The Further Adventures of Paul, Did Women Exercise Pastoral Power in the First 200 Years? Most of the program says 100 years. That might be a little bit confusing. The New Testament contains sparse and contradictory information regarding the pastoral roles of women. However, the early centuries of the Common Era can provide additional information regarding the constitution of the early Christian communities. In this paper, my thesis is that there is more evidence than has been generally realized for women exercising pastoral power in the early centuries. What is new in this paper is the use of a post-structural reading of texts as a way of bringing information to bear on the question of women as Christian leaders. The paper begins with a survey of the historiography and then discusses the contribution of Ignatius to our picture of late 2nd to early 3rd centuries. I will next examine the pastoral practices of baptism and Eucharist, drawing particularly from the apocryphal Acts. I am attempting to demonstrate that the process of defining women's roles is a method of controlling them. You should note that I speak to you today as a historian with a different set of assumptions and norms, i.e., as a non-Mormon. Furthermore, my topic was originally conceived without reference to LDS thought. Nevertheless, we do share some topics of common concern. In this presentation, women in early Christianity. Hopefully, some Mormons here wholeheartedly agree with the editors of the independent Mormon publication Dialogue, who state their wish to bring their faith into dialogue with the larger stream of Judeo-Christian thought. This ongoing dialogue is exactly why the RLDS philosopher of religion, Robert Mesley, stated for a Mormon audience, quote, the restoration movements have tended to elevate historical claims to the level of theological dogma, close quote. The problem of this position for the historian, as Mesley notes, is that it denies the reality of historical process by asserting that ideas, institutions, social relationships, and even written texts drop out of a timeless heaven rather than emerging from the historical process of human struggle. The very term restoration points to one major expression of this ahistorical tendency, the claim that the true church consists of an eternal, non-historical priesthood, structure, and authority. Close quote. The historian asks whether Jesus established a priesthood structure and authority similar to one which now exists in one or more of the restoration churches. Mesley states, the answer, in my opinion, is no, on the grounds that Jesus apparently established no priesthood structure at all. He concludes, what information we do have, however, is overwhelming against the traditional Mormon view of early Christianity. Close quote. The launching of our optimistic dialogue appears to have run aground. Fortunately, in the Journal of Mormon History, the historian of early Christianity, John G. Gager, has succinctly outlined three fruitful parallels between early Christianity and Mormonism. He notes that, quote, just as early Christianity gradually modified its exclusivist stance as it moved into the mainstream of Roman society and culture, the same has been true of Mormonism. But concurrent with this movement, we must note, in the case of both religions, of three accompanying reactions which may be seen as virtually inevitable. The first I would define as a counter-movement directed precisely at tendencies toward accommodation and assimilation. This counter-movement, typified in early Christianity by the figure of Tertullian, insists, in the end, unsuccessfully, on preserving the full measure of cultural distinctiveness for the developing religion. The second reaction, ironically, takes the form of defining heresy, or at least one form of heresy, in terms of those groups within the religion which adhere most closely to the original practices and beliefs of the early movement. The third reaction, closely related to the second, arises in response to the crisis prompted by the disappearance of the first generation of charismatic leaders, i.e., Jesus and the original disciples. There is evidence from the second century which points to a dispute between two groups concerning the nature of legitimate authority within the developing church. Close quote. These three reactions of 1, counter-movement typified by Tertullian, 2, the defining of heresy, and 3, a dispute over the nature of legitimate authority are central to this presentation. In this paper, I will present evidence of Tertullian's restrictions on the proper roles of women at the beginning of the 3rd century. Furthermore, the early precedent of women's leadership in the church practices came to be later identified with heretical practice. And thirdly, major disputes in the 2nd century consisted of problems of authority. What books were authoritative, who would occupy positions of leadership, and what was the authentic tradition? The title of this paper, The Further Adventures of Paul, describes the less familiar traditions about Paul that existed in the Apocryphal Acts. The Apocryphal Acts are not determined by theological reflections, but rather by practical intentions. The practical intentions of the authors are best described as entertainment. By way of making a present-day parallel to the Apocryphal Acts, we might compare them to such popular soap operas as Dallas or Falcon Crest. To make the analogy even more exact, I would compare the picture of American society portrayed by these shows when viewed by, let us say, Western Europeans. The Western European viewer realizes that one is not watching a realistic portrayal of American society. Shenanigans like J.R. Ewing's and Angela Channing's are not the standard fare of a PBS documentary. The viewer is thoroughly aware that he is enjoying entertainment, which can nevertheless reveal some things about American society and culture. Popular American television entertainment reveals the power struggles, the infighting, family battles, and other common characteristics of our society. In the same way, the Apocryphal Acts, since they are popular entertainment, reveal something significant about the social world of the early Christians. Now that I have discussed the relevant historiography, what is my approach? For the early Christian movement, the 2nd century was a significant transitional period. For example, without a sure guide from any one source, such as the emerging canon of the New Testament, oral tradition, or personal authority, the early Christians had to decide among themselves who would exercise pastoral power in leading the practices of baptism and the Eucharist. One such formulation of policy, especially intriguing to 20th century Christians, concerns the question of whether women were considered qualified to exercise pastoral power in the early community. The number of relevant texts is small, but as this paper will show, they do reveal a common concern with the dilemma of who will lead. Though researchers have long been examining these narratives, few, if any, have focused on the Apocryphal Acts using post-structural ideas. Therefore, the analyst must place a narrative into the transmitted movement of shifting power relations. The story of pastoral power thus belongs to a chain of speeches by which this cultural community is constituted and by which this community itself interprets itself by means of narratives. Let me begin my discussion of Ignatius of Antioch, the foremost churchman of his day, by presenting a general picture of how he defined acceptable roles for women. Ignatius outlines the social order and structure of the church as pertaining to women. Widows are not to be neglected. He urges that nothing be done without your approval, referring to Polycarp. The authority of office is based upon a chain of command from God. Women do not share in the authority of office, but even at this early stage, they are defined as a class by the hierarchy. Marriage is of special concern to Ignatius. Wives are to be satisfied with their husbands, whereas the brothers are to love their mates, and a man or a woman is not to take another spouse. William R. Shadell comments that episcopal authority is also the main issue in the words about marriage. Ignatius requires the couple seeking marriage to seek the blessing of the bishop. This development put into the hands of the bishop a potent instrument of social control, group endogamy, and no doubt contributed significantly to the tightly knit texture of the Christian community. Ignatius has a cautious attitude in regard to celibacy. Since Ignatius understands the union of flesh and spirit as a mark of the church, he regards celibacy with some reserve, indeed as a potential challenge to episcopal authority. Henosis, union or marriage, is also used elsewhere as a metaphor for the solidarity of the church. Ignatius draws together the opposites of flesh and spirit, but the emergence of a polarized ascetic elite poses a challenge to such a conception of the Christian community. The order of widows arose as a means to structure the sexuality of women. Denied to women was a symbolic power of having more children, as well as participating in their sexuality as marriageable women. For the first 2 centuries of the Common Era, The order of widows was in some sense an active order. Ignatius greets virgins called widows as one of the main social groups in the community. The order of widows was opened up to virgins, especially older women, who had no other means of support. The roles of women in Ignatius are in stark contrast to those outlined in the Apocryphal Acts. Women take a more active role in pastoral positions, and widows in particular rebel against the conventions of their time. This is circa 160 to 225, the Common Era. Just as in the popular expression, nature abhors a vacuum, the chief aim of the Apocryphal Acts was to supplement the New Testament, although with sharply contrasted viewpoints. The Apocryphal Acts were written for inspiring Christian ideals, and since they were not condemned as heretical, it is safe to say that the ideas contained in them reflect acceptable early teaching. In the standard work of Hennecke Schneemelker, the importance of the Acts for historical understanding is underscored. Hennecke Schneemelker observes, quote, "The Apocryphal Acts are the most important witnesses to the religious ideals of a great part of the Christian race, ideals which did not always follow the paths which were later considered acceptable to the Christian church. An acquaintance with these ideals, however, is beyond question of the utmost importance for the historical understanding of conditions in the church of the second and third centuries." Close quote. The popular audience who was taught these stories is a testimony to the acceptable surface practices that they contain. The Apocryphal Acts are historically worthwhile because they're acceptable to some groups as doctrinally correct. In contrast to Ignatius's qualified appreciation of the ascetic life, in the Acts, these ideal figures serve as role models for members of the community. The encratite, or continent strain, is thought to be the essential Christian message. Women are urged to discipline their own bodies in the pursuit of Christian perfection. Clearly, the writings of Ignatius do provide some clues that women were important in the early Christian community. However, it is to the Apocryphal Acts that we must look for actual instances in which women were able to carry out important leadership positions. In the study of baptism and Eucharistic practice, the usual procedure is to seek salvation themes in baptism or the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But the next step in this paper is to discover the significance of the surface practices of baptism and Eucharist, for example, in the relationship to the role of women in early Christianity. Who were Christian leaders in the second century? No one could properly claim priestly authority, since the only New Testament text concerning priesthood, the Book of Hebrews, does not apply priesthood to functions such as baptism or the Eucharist. Indeed, it applies priesthood to Jesus alone and in a unique way. The early Christians needed to decide among themselves who would exercise pastoral power. The Acts of Paul and Thecla was written as a religious tract in the late second century. It is my major example of acceptable baptismal and Eucharistic practice. Thecla, the heroine of the story, breaks her engagement to her fiancé in favor of following the Apostle Paul. She causes an uproar, and a governor attempts to quiet the crowds by eliminating Thecla. I pick up the story where she is about to be killed. "Then they threw in many beasts, while she stood and stretched out her hands and prayed. When she finished her prayer, she turned and saw a large pit filled with water, and she said, 'Now is the right time for me to baptize myself.' And she threw her in self, saying, 'In the name of Jesus Christ, I baptize myself on the last day.' Thecla, in a moment of crisis, asserts herself despite the disapproval of those in her social world. Her example is one instance of an acceptable story that was circulated orally in order to edify and entertain Christians. Tertullian marks the end of the popular acceptance of women baptizing and teaching. In the early 3rd century, women were being excluded from pastoral positions. Women could no longer appeal to the popular example of Thecla. Tertullian, in his treatise on baptism, inveighs against counting an episode from the Acts of Paul and Thecla as a legitimation for women being allowed to baptize. Tertullian should be seen as initiating the exclusionary rhetoric in baptismal practice. The sparse evidence from the New Testament is an early witness that up until this time, women did exercise pastoral power. Tertullian joined the Montanists, who were well known for their two main prophetesses, an indication that the non-pastoral and charismatic roles could still be held by women. Patricia Wilson Kastner observes, "The women prophets are the vehicles of the Holy Spirit, to be listened to with respect, but are not given a role in the hierarchy in Tertullian's system." But by contrast, in the Acts of Paul and Thecla, there is an incident of women leading a Eucharistic service, apparently with the approval of the Apostle Paul. This is an example of acceptable Eucharistic practice. Lemma the widow and her daughter Amia were holding an agape, or Eucharistic service. The text states that it was they who gave the agape. These women held the agape despite the presence of the Apostle Paul, who, in a similar incident, celebrates the Eucharist. Thus, I have presented evidence from the Acts of Paul and Thecla for women exercising pastoral power in both rituals of baptism and Eucharist. The author of a later text, the Acts of Exanthippa, is thoroughly familiar with the Acts of Paul and Thecla. Therefore, it is possible that the Acts of Exanthippa is a reworking of the Acts of Paul and Thecla. If this is the case, the Acts of Exanthippa is an attempt to explain away the leading roles of women in early Christian rituals. Allow me to compare the treatment of women's baptism in the two works. A woman boldly exercises her prerogative of self-baptism in the Acts of Paul and Thecla. In a striking contrast, Exanthippa approaches Paul for baptism only to be denied. It is worth noting, however, that when Exanthippa's husband requests baptism, he receives it instantly. Paul is subtly criticized since the text states that all this was done by the evil one, that Exanthippa might receive holy baptism with tribulation and be faint-hearted concerning the commandments of Christ. The criticism of Paul is whether he is presented as being unduly influenced by the evil one. The reworked Acts of Exanthippa replaces the leading roles that women had exercised with claims that are just below pastoral positions. The second half of the second century marks the end of the presider rhetoric, which contained the technical terminology allowing women to preside at the Eucharist. With the rejection of the apocryphal Acts as authoritative, women were no longer able to justify their presiding over the Eucharistic celebration. Only in the subtle and muted protests of women in the apocryphal Acts, circa 160 to 225 of the Common Era, do we hear the increasing restriction on the sexuality of women, and their subsequent redefinition and regulation. The detailed church orders of the second quarter of the second century do not reflect the earlier roles of women baptizing and consecrating the Eucharist. In conclusion, I've examined power as an analytical tool in order to reflect some of the shades of rhetoric in early Christianity. The analysis is centered on the surface practices of baptism and Eucharist in order to determine who would exercise pastoral power. The analysis has not focused on the New Testament because when one examines the role of women, it only presents contradictory evidence. The later texts are examined in order to avoid this confusion. I've also sought to avoid viewing the first century as a golden age, and then compounding that mistake with seeing the later centuries as a falling from grace. The way is open for a more accurate historical inquiry into the period. One final note. Have you ever noticed when Jesus is in conflict with his opponents, he does not lose his identity? However, when women come in conflict with others in the apocryphal Acts, they are redefined and therefore lose their former identity. They are redefined and lose this former identity, even though the fullness of human identity is to be like God. On the other hand, do you notice in these conflicts how little attention is directed toward the evolution of church ceremonies? As Jesus said, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. The aim of religious ritual is simple. We should be the ones who judge whether religious rituals, at least in a Christian context, express our fully human identity as a love of God and neighbor. Today, many churches are defining the roles of women and whether they can hold the priesthood. I hope that the present-day conflicts are not simply another repetition of women's further loss of identity. Paraphrasing Santayana's famous dictum, Langdon Gilkey observed in the Journal of Mormon History, "Those religious communities who do not seek to understand sociologically and historically their role in society and the dangers and possibilities of that role in the light of their theological and ethical traditions are condemned to repeat the worst errors of church history and so to endanger their religious task within the world." As Gilkey points out, with the stakes so high and the potential losses so great, dare we shirk from the task. Thank you.
Nick's paper raises points worthy of our attention, and it was very difficult for me to restrict my remarks, but I will try to keep my response brief so that Mick can respond to my response if he wishes to. He will want to. The issue of priesthood structure in antiquity, the problems of using biblical scripture as proof text for or against women functioning in priesthood offices, as well as the comparison between Mormon church development and the development of the early church have all been addressed before, and these articles have been published in past issues of Dialogue. So I would like to focus on mixed use of the Acts of Paul and Thecla as evidence for women's participation in what are now considered by the LDS Church as priesthood functions. And also I would like to comment on his idea that documents of public discourse which indicate concern with women's roles show an early attempt within Christianity to control women. And I would like to add that adopting the concerns of women and institutionalizing their groups facilitated the controlling effect of these discourses. My reading of the Acts of Paul and Thecla resulted in a very different interpretation. The story is a fascinating one. We read of a woman who refuses to marry and refuses to be seduced, refusals which result in extreme tortures and sentences of death, all of which she survives miraculously. Thecla remains a free woman. The story seems to be a curious combination of a tale of a woman managing to maintain her independence and Paul's teachings of celibacy. Throughout, there is not much sense of reality. For example, Thecla is tied to a stake and the townspeople attempt to burn her, a punishment not for being Christian, but for breaking her engagement. I couldn't find any evidence that this was done during the first and second centuries. In previous centuries, a death sentence could be given for adultery, but this was not Thecla's crime. To me, the story reads more like a woman's fantasy, an ancient romance tale that has been overlaid with the late second century developing ideal of virginity. A literal reading of the text to find out what was going on in the lives of women is about as valid as using an episode of Dallas as an example of American family life. These popular soap operas do not illustrate common characteristics of our society, as Mick stated. They reflect our fantasies, just as Paul and Thecla may reflect second century fantasies. Thecla baptizing herself fits into the idea of her independence from men, and I don't know of any source which sanctions self-baptisms. I believe the Acts of Paul and Thecla cannot be used in any respect as evidence that women baptized with apostolic approval. Women did, however, baptize. There is evidence of that in the writings denouncing heretical groups. But why would this popular tale be used by the early church fathers? As Mick has shown, the subject of what women should and should not do was a matter of public discourse in the second century. There was concern with the subject earlier, but in the first century there seemed to be an equal concern with the roles of men. And to me it is not as offensive to discuss the roles of women if the roles of men are also discussed. It's just when there is, you know, a gross imbalance, as there seems to be today. I think Ignatius' letters, which Mick referred to, are similar to Paul's teachings in this respect. Ignatius does discuss ethical behavior that is required of men as well as women. The gross imbalance apparently began in the second century. The questions I wish I had the answer to are, why are the church fathers so concerned with women's role, and why was virginity set up as an ideal? And I know apparently Mick, as a historian, likes to avoid the why questions, but to me they are the essentials. So that's my thinking is why. Mick states that defining women's roles was simply a way of controlling women, but that raises the question, why would they want to control women? I can't buy wholly the argument, although it is a good one, that this tendency was a result of the influences of the Jewish patriarchal structure and Hellenism. It is true that women have never had it very good, but within the Roman world, things were getting better, and Christianity was so revolutionary in its teachings that all humanity was of equal worth in the sight of God that it seems to me this would have been a good time for old habits to end. I believe that when there is institutionalized suppression of women, there are benefits to be had by someone, regardless of the theological whys and wherefores. There must have been benefits for the early church leaders. Mick referred to the Order of Widows as an early ecclesiastical group that may have performed functions the LDS Church now considers to be priesthood functions. Christianity attracts wealthy widows. These women had the time and the financial means to participate in the missionary activities of the early church. They either financed other missionaries or they went on missionary adventures themselves. In the Acts of Paul and Thecla, there is reference to a widow who gave all her money to Paul. It was Roman law at this time that women could inherit the wealth of their husbands. That had not always been the case. Roman marriage law is very complicated, and it wasn't automatic that a woman would inherit her husband's wealth, but at this time, more than previously, the chances were that she would. And it was also law that widows had to remarry within a given time. The law at one time was that they had to remarry within a year, and then that, under protest, was changed to within 3 years. But throughout history, women have been remarkable in their ability to circumvent the law. So it's not to say that this was the law is not to say that every woman was married within a year after the death of her husband. At the time of remarriage, the new husband would probably control the woman's inheritance. Now, many of these women donated their money to the church, so as long as the women maintained control of their money, there would be a better chance that money would be given to the church. It would be a financial advantage to the church then to encourage these women not to remarry and to give them a sense of participation. The Order of Widows, which may have been simply an informal gathering initiated by women for women of common interests, was formally organized as an auxiliary organization. Such formalization would eventually facilitate control of the group by the church hierarchy. Back to the tale of Paul and Thecla. Church fathers wishing to encourage widows not to remarry or wishing to encourage wealthy women to remain single could easily utilize the popular fiction of the time. Simply by giving the heroine a Christian motive for maintaining her virginity, Paul's teachings could be easily manipulated for this purpose. The simple fantasy of being free of men and independent became remaining chaste for Christ. The effect would be the same, keeping women single, only now their allegiance would be to the church, for whom they were being celibate. The problem with the Thecla tale is the self-baptism incident, which Tertullian stated did not indicate women could have the authority to baptize. Otherwise, the tale suited their purpose as well. There is not much evidence, either for or against my reconstruction, but there is ample evidence in our own time of these power dynamics. There is no reason to assume that people were so extraordinarily different in the second century that the power games played today were not played then. The apparent absence of women's voices in documents of antiquity requires us to find creative ways of seeing their presence. Half of humanity did not live and die without leaving a mark. And I look to women's history to Mormon history for possible parallels. And it is in this point that I wanted Kathy to stress that I was responding as a Mormon woman and not as a scholar, because right now I am at odds with historical methodology, because I think those methodologies which are accepted as valid within the historical community, I think intrinsically exclude women's history, and I think the proof is self-evident. As Mick has stated, the indications of these subtle power plays are found in discourses. When the women's movement of this generation began, there occurred within the church a proliferation of talk of women. There have always been such talk, but when I was growing up, I don't remember announcements of firesides on the subject. Now that the general authorities seem to have accepted the idea that the movement for equality is not going to die, these concerns of women have been appropriated by them. That is, they have been given verbal acknowledgement and then twisted rather oddly. President Hinckley's talk given at the Women's Conference of last September is an excellent example. In that speech, he acknowledges the advancements, quote, "all of us rejoice in the enlargement of opportunities for women," unquote. But women should not complain of discrimination. They should look at all God has given them, and then he carefully outlines the 10, just 10, great positive privileges God has endowed women by inheritance. What he does not mention is that in the history of each of these 10 privileges, there have been times when they have been either partially restricted to all by narrow definitions or completely restricted to segments of the female population of the church. They are now, in quotes, inherited privileges because women complained. The most recent example is the privileges numbered 7 and 8, blessings of the temple and ministering in the temple. Until this past year, these privileges were denied women who had married non-members. So it was organized after the manner of the priesthood, and Joseph Smith or one of the male leaders seemed to be ever present at the meetings giving discourses which encouraged women down the path they wanted them to go. If Joseph Smith was not present, then he was constantly giving Emma advice on what she should say to the women. And still today, this organization is held up to us as being parallel to the priesthood quorums, when in reality it is not, and continues to be used as a tool to further explain to women their proper roles. again referring to President Hinckley's talk, privilege number four is the right to preside, quote, as executives in the truest sense, unquote, and our Impotent Relief Society presidents are given as examples. To me, the Relief Society just clouds reality. I genuinely do not want to stomp all over Hinckley. I do not attribute a conscious malicious intent to his conference address. Yesterday, Doris Elliott presented an excellent literary analysis of this speech, which caused me to realize that all of us, men and women alike, are diminished when we are unable to rise above our culture. What I would like to underscore in Mick's paper is the idea that public discourses, which outline the role of women, are attempts to control women. It was true in antiquity. It is true today. What I would like to emphasize in responding is that in the history of the early church, as well as the history of Mormonism, the control of women accomplished by public discourses was facilitated by adopting and manipulating the perceived concerns of women and institutionalizing their groups. When a newly appointed bishop comes into the Relief Society and tells us that the women's movement is the greatest social movement of the history of the century, and he does not give the same speech to men, there is reason to pause and ask ourselves, what's going on here? Maybe there's nothing, and maybe there's a lot we should be concerned about. Actually, I feel very optimistic after studying for this paper. Now I realize that practically since the beginning of recorded history, men have been busy defining the roles of women, and women have been busy essentially ignoring them. So men feel the need to give the same speeches over and over again. It's a pattern that's just repetitive throughout history. But throughout history, some women have managed to do what they have wanted and needed to do. Some women have baptized, some women have participated in the Eucharist, some have prophesied, some have blessed and anointed the sick. Whether or not they did it with church approval is debatable. But some women did do what they willed to do. In spite of all the efforts to suppress women, some women are not suppressible. Thank you.
Just make a couple quick comments to the response. I'm not sure I can grant the point about the argument itself being based on the use of acts, the use of acts of Paul and Thecla. That seems to be the problem here with public discourse. My point is, since it is public discourse, it's open for public debate, and I think that's the strength of the argument. In the second century, there's all kinds of texts being excluded and being called heretical, being thrown out of the church and whatnot, and it's not until the 3rd century and with Tertullian that same thing is done to the Acts of Paul and Thecla. So my point is, since it's public, since it's entertainment, since people are passing this thing around as a way of inculcating Christian ideals, it must have been acceptable. So I think that's the strength of the argument. I also disagree with Janet's comment about my reading of the text. And what I'm trying to do is not so much like read the text literally or symbolically or anything. My point is simply that this is a surface practice. If nothing else, you can read a text and you can interpret it all kinds of different ways, but we know that here's a practice where a woman exercised baptism. So if we look at just that, the surface practice of it, that's nothing more. It's not so much reading the text, it's just something which is done and acceptable at least to some people because it is public, because it is entertainment, because they're passing it around as more or less good thing, because no one is saying that it's not a good thing and that you can't do it. But there is a battle for the canon. There is a battle for what books are to be included in the New Testament or not. And, it's much later that Thecla herself is considered not a good person. All throughout the Middle Ages, even, people are still trying to refer back to Thecla, remember Thecla in the early church, etc., etc. So I'm saying her popularity is an example of people still trying to hold on to that early Christian ideal of women exercising the most important rituals of early Christianity, that is baptism and Eucharist.
We have time for questions if you'd like to ask anything, and please address which speaker you would like to address your question to.
What she feels is intrinsic in Mormon historical methodology, or maybe the general historical methodology, which makes it intrinsically sexist. And that is not a challenging question.
I'm curious.
No, because I suspect that there are inherent limitations in any discipline. You have the point of view mentioned but not elaborated, that these limitations also may have certain sexist elements to the
I think a primary criticism, it wasn't specifically a Mormon methodology, but Mormon methodology is historical methodology, I guess, is the emphasis on logical thinking. And I think that could exclude women. And I don't mean by that women are irrational or illogical. I just mean that most historians will now, it's not popular to be of the positive school, but I think that most historians are essentially scientific in their manner, and that could possibly exclude considerations of evidence, or possibly exclude ways of thinking, looking at the evidence. It has been, until social history became such a big deal, it was considered, journals, for example, were not considered as valid historical documents. And it's just been within the past 20 or 30 years where we find that they are valid. And probably a woman's history may well be contained within journals. So that is an example of a type of document that would not have been considered. But the challenge is to try to learn to think in a way that is not logical, but and that's very, very difficult, I mean, to try to come up with a new way of thinking that will allow us to include women within history.
During the first and second century, is there any thousand credit information regarding women's subservient, equal, or greater role in marriage? You mentioned baptism and Eucharist. Was during that period of time also marriage considered a sacrament? And women being a necessary part of that sacrament, was it seen? Can you comment on it, the validity or the importance of marriage in that early period of church history, women's role therein?
Well, as a Catholic, of course, marriage is a sacrament. Everybody knows it. No, marriage is, you know, again, that's kind of a problem area because a lot of the texts are later. The only one, again, I didn't look at it specifically for this talk or recently, so I couldn't answer anything directly towards it, other than the one comment I made about Ignatius, where he's looking at marriage. In fact, that's not a bad theme. I was actually thinking about trying to do some research within the next year on that very topic, so it's certainly relevant. The only thing, I don't want to talk prematurely because I'm afraid I'm reading something into the text that's not there. Because of the comment where I think it's significant off the cuff, but I haven't looked at it closely enough, Ignatius says that, you know, the wives are to be satisfied with the husbands, whereas the husband, the brother, he says, is to love the wife. And just the fact that there's different language, you know, the first question I want to know is, you know, well, what's the difference? You know, why does the woman have to be satisfied with the husband, whereas the man can love the woman? It seems, again, it's a type of thing where it says, you know, the woman is put in the passive role, that she is, well, just be satisfied and just accept things as they are. You know, that's only one thing that I've said, you know, recently or that I've come across. But I'd like to look at it. I think the problem with it is that a lot of the texts about marriage are going to be later, you know, 4th and 5th century, because, you know, offhand, I can't recall anything really earlier. And I think that's the problem. I don't want to read back into the earlier centuries what were later debates, 4th and 5th, and maybe even medieval debates.
I'm not sure I can quite explain what I want to ask, but it's addressed to Janet. And comment at the very end where you talked about men continually telling women how to behave or what they should be and women ignoring them, seems in a way potentially, well, I'm not sure what you're saying, because your first statement seems to suggest something somewhat more subtle, and that is in fantasy. You were reading the text in through the eyes of women, and deriving a different meaning than if you read the same text through the eyes of man. And it's the question that Doris raised yesterday about the italicized text. Mm-hmm. That is, women overtly conforming, using the language, accepting the pronouncements, and so on. and yet attributing to those and somehow embedding in those very different meanings. And I was wondering about that in relation to contemporary church. I mean, there seems to be, can you dismiss the Relief Society quite so out of hand? Do you see now in the contemporary church any italicized reading or any separatist culture developing within that something that's apparently just serving the patriarchy? I don't know. That's a long question. I'm not sure if I made
Are you asking me if I think that we should just start baptizing? That women should start baptizing?
Oh, no. No, no. I'm talking, I guess I'm really building, because you were there at the same session in literary criticism, where you can't just take a literal reading of what's happening. There can be a feminist subtext. I think that feminist literary critics talk about subtext and muted text. And I thought you were applying that beautifully to a historical situation, seeing a subtext in the story of the Apocryphal Acts that was referred to. But maybe I misunderstood you. Maybe that's not what you were
saying. No, that is what I was trying to do. And it's difficult to say, well, women are not suppressible, and then look about us and see that women have been suppressed. You know, that there is a subtext, but women, we're hearing only the text, and it's working in a certain extent. But I think that as women, we have to stop looking at ourselves as oppressed and acknowledge that throughout history, women have done what they have willed to do. And to just consider, you know, just for us to acknowledge that we can do what we want and or what we feel, you know, what we are inspired to do. You know, that we have that freedom regardless of what the text tells us, regardless of the discourse. And I think a beginning is by being sensitive to what else is being said when talks are given. Just being sensitive to that helps us overcome it.
May I ask you the question that you also asked, Jen? If you disregard authority and will what you will, then does that mean that you would say women should baptize and do anointing things on their own without, or how do you fit into this authority?
I think the question of women and priesthood must begin with an understanding of what priesthood is and what authority is and how the church hierarchy fits into priesthood authority. And the best example is one, as I was thinking, my own family. If we describe or define priesthood as the power of God, then within my family, my mother's faith has been the power of God in our family. And my mother has been the priesthood in our family. And I think that women first need to, before they start clamoring for priesthood authority, need to have a clear understanding of what priesthood is. And I think when that, and that may be a very personal, individual understanding, it may never be something we can come to a consensus about, but I think with that understanding, then the issue of whether or not women should baptize, or whether or not women should be on the High Council, or whether or not women should be a president of the church, just kind of will fall by the way.
I think sometimes, well, always, I think the first time talking about women, you know, your suggestion, well, we have to understand what priesthood is. I think in some ways we're missing the boat because I still don't understand what womanhood is. And the assumption that in order to understand womanhood, we have to understand priesthood maybe a little bit backwards, which is still another indication that we're buying into the fact that in order for us to survive, we have to understand and work in man's world. And so that I think women operate in women's world and in man's world. But men don't operate in women's world. And I wonder to what extent women need to understand more about their world just to be able to articulate it to men. I agree, I think, with the essence of what you're saying. But I don't think we'll ever understand priesthood until we understand womanhood.
Well, to me, the two are tied. I think if you want to look, if you want to concentrate on learning about priesthood, you will learn about womanhood. If you want to look at learning about womanhood, you will learn about priesthood. So it's just a matter of emphasis, I suppose.
I don't think that, no.
I'm not sure I'm following your question. If it's the question of authority, you know.
What, from your evidence, what there was concern about authority early on.
Definitely.
Why was there concern?
Well, I'm going to say that's in the nature of things, or that's in, you know, of course people are going to be concerned about authority, because who has the authority, who doesn't have the authority is, you know, irrelevant to any group that's trying to organize itself. And I'm claiming from reading the second century text that here is a church that is having tremendous pressures for organization, and how it's going to organize is very relevant. What text it's going to use, who's going to lead at the community celebrations, and things like that. The reason I'm trying to focus on public displays of authority, and I would argue power, is because this is the way the community makes legitimate those people or whoever it is that's using those tasks. No one will deny that women can exercise power privately, but you know, I look at those things as gender specific. Women exercise power in private realms, whereas men have exercised power in public realms. And the reason I'm focusing on those two things, baptism and Eucharist, is because they're public celebrations and they're public displays of authority. And if they're only men, then the men say, well, only men have authority, which certain churches have argued. But if you can find women in public roles, then you can say men and women are exercising authority. And there is New Testament evidence for women doing almost everything that a man is doing, preaching, being a missionary, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm trying to focus on public things because that's the institution making legitimate what authority and how authority is being delegated.
I'll give an ignorant response. I think when churches are adopting, when other faiths are adopting the practice of ordaining women to the priesthood, they're not doing it because they have found specific evidence within the New Testament that women baptized with apostolic authority. I think they're finding evidence that there was no specific priesthood structure. That women were not excluded. There's no evidence that they were included. There's no evidence that they were excluded. Except for with the Eucharist, I think there's plenty of examples where women did do that, but there's no indication that was a priesthood function in the sense that we think a priesthood function is. It seemed to be that the priesthood in the early church was more charismatic, more spiritual, that if you felt the desire to serve, you served in the ways that your spirituality expressed. You know, your spiritual gifts were important. If you prophesied, if you had prophetic gifts, you prophesied. If you had gifts of bearing testimony, you bore testimony. And those were more the offices and functions of the early church. So, and I do think that you're correct. I think that the Mormon church is probably going to eventually say that women had priesthood all along, because we have had priesthood all along, and it is a challenge to us to manifest it.
Yeah, I would say from the New Testament itself, I would say my reason for believing on what priesthood is from the New Testament, and particularly the book of Hebrews and 1 Peter. And I would say that the tradition could accept the priesthood for a male or for men or women if one can identify with Christ close enough and in such a way. Priesthood is applied to Jesus alone in the book of Hebrews, but one could argue from 1 Peter that it's a holy nation, a priesthood, et cetera, et cetera. If you can see those texts as saying that men and women are in fact priests, with the example that you picked out, I'm not sure offhand why the Lutheran Church would do this, but there is New Testament evidence for such a thing, and the text that they're possibly using is Romans 16:2, where Phoebe is described in a mistranslation, in most mistranslations, as something like helper. You read it in English and you say, you know, helper, you know, what does that mean? It means almost nothing, and you can make it mean anything you want. But the same word is in the sense of what we would call like a deacon or a deaconess, which there is precedent in the early church for women exercising, and that is a priestly type of activity. In the Catholic tradition, also women, for example, will assist the priest during the Eucharist, distributing communion, etc., and lecturing, reading the word at the assembly. So the idea is that what they're trying to do is to remind themselves as that there are precedent for women exercising these particular rituals that we might consider priesthood. Most theology in traditional Christianity, Lutheran, Episcopal, Catholic, etc., are looking at priesthood in terms of directly applying them to Jesus, the phrase prophet, priest, and king. So if you can make the individual Christian identified with that Christ-like mission of prophet, priest, and king, then why couldn't they lead in any type of church activity? So the problem is to try and get the identification of women with Christ's mission of prophet, priest, and king. You might argue that they have the prophet part, and you might argue that they have the kingly part. I'm not so sure, but you've got to see the prophet, priest, and king theme of Jesus.
Are you implying that perhaps the fact that the man is male means that he's standing in as Christ? I mean, specifically within our rituals, there are some instances of that. Is that what you mean?
Well,
that to say a woman would do it, that would kind of diminish?
No, why don't you maybe use the reverse? Perhaps there are some rituals that should only be performed by a woman. Perhaps there are some rituals that should only be performed.
Well, what would be the reasons why it should be performed only by a woman or a man? I'm not arguing with you. I just am trying to clarify so I know how to respond. Well, I think, considering the rituals we have in our church, there are a few where the ritual is performed by a man because he is acting as Christ. And I think that with an expanded understanding of the Godhead, I don't think there would be a problem with putting a woman in that place. But to me, it's not offensive that a man is always performs in that spot. If that, I don't know how else to respond.
I think
in attempts to make things a little more equal within our church, I don't think there's any woman who is advocating a denial to men of those rituals which reinforce their fatherhood or their feeling of godhood or anything like that. It's just that a woman also needs to be able to express within ritual her motherhood and her godhood.
If you have any more questions, I'm sure you can come up and ask them, but we need to close now. Thanks for coming.